Deborah Hunt. Again, we've read your evidence, thank you very much for that. You don't need to reread it, but you're welcome to highlight key points and then we'll go to questions.
Thank you, yes. So, yes, just in terms of highlighting the key points, I do understand that Deva and Lambeth presented also similar evidence around findings from the Southland Economic Report.
Yep. And we also have copies of that report.
Right.
We were given that some time ago and I'm sure we've all read it.
Sure, thank you. So I guess there's two key messages here, I think, and it's more by way of background for your consideration around the plan, but on page 3 we say that deer farms are diverse and complex production systems, and I think if you look at that diagram, you can see that the deer farms, which were normally deer farms, and the majority of their incomes were derived from deer farming, only one of them was pure deer, and the rest were had a range of different mixed livestock. And then even if you look at some of the sheep and beef farms, a number of them run deer as a minor component of their mix. So leading on from that, there's a slight revision to my text. I've stated there that over 70% of deer farms operating as a mixed livestock operation. This was taken from a survey done 5 years ago. When I went back to look at that survey, I actually made a mistake in the submission and a number of other regional plan submissions. Is actually over 80% of deer farms.
Which paragraph of your
evidence? So page 3,
yeah.
Paragraph 7, directly underneath the figure,
yeah.
The first sentence. This is consistent with our own survey and observations that over 70% of deer farms operate. So it's actually over 80%.
Okay, so that's 70, we should cross it out and write an 80.
80, yes.
Thanks for that.
And that was 5 years ago, and we would expect that the trend has been towards more diversification, so we would think that more deer farms are going to start. The second key point arising from looking at the economic project report is that farms with low inputs for production generally have few options for mitigation. And in particular, when we're looking at the deer farming situation, one which was most effective was fence pacing and wallowing as a mitigation option. So the figure which is presented there, if you look at the yellow lines and dots, you can see that pretty much in all cases they result in a reduction in phosphorus, which is good. And by reduction in phosphorus, we also associate that with a reduction in sediment loss. But you'll also notice that it's accompanied by decrease in profitability. So there are options, there are limited options, but it does come at a cost. I'd also like to table to the panel the figure that's there, and I do apologise for this. This was I've been involved in the economic project, and I must have been using an earlier draft because it's actually not the same figure that appears in the final report. So I'll just table that to give you another piece of paper to consider.
Thank you.
The biggest difference is in the nutrient, one farm having a nutrient input change, so that's the red bar on farm 40, and another farm, farm 45, having a change in the stock policy. So that's a drafting error, but essentially for the purposes of this statement, which we're focusing on fence pacing and wallowing, there's absolutely no change. So really those are the key points, and then jumping to the conclusions. As Richard has outlined previously, the rules designed to set thresholds for permitted activities such as setback distances and winter grazing seem to be overly restrictive and don't really reflect the nature of dry stock farmers, as Richard and other submitters have stated. And so much of the concerns for DFA Southland could be addressed through the development of the farm environment management plans, which DFA endorses. And that within those plans, that allows the farmers to justify the need for setbacks, the extent of winter grazing required, and identify alternative approaches to excluding stock, such as the example that Richard's going to cover off with the environment focused farm. And then the final point is that the considerable resourcing required for this which will really require collaboration and trust between the council, the fund, the community, and industry good organisations such as DFA, DINS, and BFNM. And we would think that would offer a much more acceptable approach and a more robust approach to reducing environmental impacts. That's really the main points from my statement. I do have some examples of environmental good management practice, pluses and minuses of these, and use of the Farm Environment Management Plan on a series of videos, which I'd like to play a few short clips for.
We were pre-circulated with a link to that. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to check that everyone in the panel's already viewed those clips.
Yes, I have
them.
Mm-hmm.
We've already viewed those clips, so we don't really need to show them again.
Yep.
But maybe the key points you wanted us to take from the video clips, maybe can you summarise that?
So I guess with the first one, the key points are that we've, through Landcare Trust and the Sustainable Farming Fund, the Deer Industry had developed a series of 15 videos spanning right across the country. Most of those 15 videos are pertinent to pretty much all regions. Perhaps in Southland, there's two or three videos in Canterbury which deal on the drought situations, which are less applicable.
Yep.
But pretty much all of them, you know, you'd see some relevance to Southland or relevance to Hawke's Bay or whatever.
Right.
So that's the first point. We sort of chose three deer farmers to illustrate some of the good management practice, the pluses and minuses around that. So the first one, Peter Allen from Southland, who I understand is going to be presenting to the panel later on this week. In the clips, the snippets which we took from his video, we wanted to focus in on his description of deer wallowing behaviour.
Right.
So we readily recognise that deer have an affinity for water, and that's principally around their wallowing habit. But I think Peter has sort of outlined that there are situations where deer do wallow, and that's in the soft, muddy bottoms where there's still water, close to waterways, and areas and situations where they don't wallow or don't create bank degradation. So I think that was quite an important aspect to tease out. And the other point that he was making was that a lot of the work that's been done on his farm and many other sheep, beef and deer farms have been done over a number of years through not necessarily regulatory pressure but through sort of a sense of values. So in his case it was 30 years where he sort of identified his risk areas, started on them, and then there's chipped away slowly. And you know, we've seen that across the country where a number of people have taking their time and taking and the affordability of their operations. The next speaker, Lyle Cullen from Canterbury, was also looking at riparian management. One of the things that we wanted to sort of focus on his video was his identification of the benefits and negatives of having these retired areas. So he had a nice area of riparian planting. He said the benefits of that was lots of vegetation to filter out the nutrients as they were running through the sediment. And then identified that, which I've seen that a number of other submitters have identified today, if you fence them off, you tend to get a lot of weeds. Mm. And so there's some significant ongoing costs management which are incurred there. The last video that we focused on is John Somerville, also from Southland, who's speaking after us. Mm. He was looking at doing LEPs. In the video, he'd just done LEP1. He's actually since done an LEP2. And that's basically sort of, he found that a good process, identified risks, but also verified a lot of the practices that he was already doing. So it's I suppose, for the deer farmers who have considered environmental management, environmental risk, it's a good check for them, and might also offer them some alternatives. The other snippet of that video was him discussing his fodder block and what are the issues to consider around strategic grazing of that, and also levels of setback. So I think the water and land plan rules sort of point to those things, but don't really tease out the nuances that are involved in them. And I think then, you know, when you have sort of rules which are a little bit legal certainty, it sort of seems to sort of gloss over the fact that there are a number of ways that you can go about doing a certain activity that can reduce your environmental impact. Mm. So that was really the purpose of the farming videos, and hopefully the panel has sort of looked at those in those contexts.
The videos are very helpful, and the summary you just gave was also very helpful to make sure we did get the key points from them. Are you happy if we see if we have questions?
Yes.
Forward to start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You haven't said directly, but am I assuming correctly that is there effect with wallowing and fence pacing on paddock size?
Not so much the wallowing. The wallowing is just natural behaviour. The fence pacing can quite often be related to fence to paddock size. There are a number of factors which cause fence pacing, and one of them might be stress. So if the paddocks are too small and they're relative to the mob in them, then they will pace the fence. They may also pace in relation to animals in a neighbouring paddock. They might also pace in relation to general lack of feed. The actual deer farmers here can sort of maybe elaborate on that. So paddock size can be a factor for fence pacing.
So that would be picked up in the farm management plan, I presume, as being a mitigating tool.
That would be picked up if you had a consultant who was aware of deer farming deer behaviour and then deer farming limitations. Or a deer farmer who obviously had a lot of experience.
Yeah, and in the videos, it made clear to me that the wallowing was more around the animal cooling itself than, and at different times of the year, more so than his own territory, marking his own territory. Is that
yes,
correct?
So again, perhaps the actual deer farmers can verify that, but the wallowing will be in response to temperature, but it also, particularly around the rut as well, that seems to be quite a big a stag behaviour as well. So, there are a number of times of the year where wallowing is more prone. I think the other point in our original submission is that wallowing also tends to be variety related. So wapiti tend to wallow less than red, and within the red, the easterns tend to wallow less. And then fellow deer don't wallow at all. It's horses for courses, deer for courses.
Thank you. So my last question is, are you concerned that the rules as are stipulated in the plan don't necessarily cover all the sectors, e.g. deer being one of the sectors, as well as you would like?
I think that's a general, yes, that's a fair observation, and again in our original submission, and the panel probably wouldn't have seen it, but in our comments on the draft, we were quite clear to point out that, if you're looking at environmental impacts, the deer are just another livestock species to consider, but their animal behaviour is actually quite different from sheep and from cattle, so you need to manage them in response to those animal behaviours, which then sort of throw open up a different set of practices.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested to know if there was anything specific that you thought through animal behaviour that we could look at and consider in the plan that would be of interest to me. But at the moment, I understand the plan is very much these are the rules for all sectors. So.
That's how I read the proposed plan.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Lindsay, can I refer you to your graph on the figure C1 and ask you to elaborate on the reasons why farm number 44 is the most profitable and the least polluting, if we can say, in terms of phosphorus.
So that was identified as being pretty much at the top of its game, already operating on a good management basis. So the note there was that there was no reduction in phosphorus because it was in terms of around fence passing, because it was pretty much done stock extrusion where it had where it was required. It had eliminated fence passing through and fenced off more ways where it required.
So was that just down to good management practices, or were there physical attributes of the farm that were important as well?
I'm actually unable to comment on the actual farms. The survey work wasn't carried out by me. It was carried out by an independent person, and there was a whole lot of confidentiality around that. So we just sort of look at the data and any sort of general observations that have been pulled out. So I'm actually unable to.
But as an expert, would you be able to hazard a guess as to the reasons for this? Would it just be good management practices, do you think?
I think there's also probably an element of where it's located. I think, you know, if you look at that, there's quite a spread of phosphorus losses and profitability, and you know, it's a small sample, but that's also apparent in the much larger sample of sheep and beef farms. You can be operating a good management practice and just be in a certain physiographic zone in a certain climate area and have some relatively high leaching rates, loss rates. Conversely, you could be in areas which are quite benign and you could get away with less than good management practice and still be within an environment that's acceptable by the level. So, I think that's the issue. There's a whole lot of variability both within the production systems and also where they're located and the challenges they face, that inevitably identifying good management practices has to be on a farm-by-farm and sub-catchable-by-sub-catchable basis. So we've identified in the series of videos a whole number of good management practices which would be applicable, but if you're in Southland, you're probably looking at the drought stuff and saying, no, that's not for me. You might look at the winter grazing and say, well, actually, I don't do a huge component of winter grazing, so you know, some of those good management practices, I'm not so good. I'm not sure that totally answers your question, but I think the complexity and the diversity of the mixed livestock farming systems makes things quite challenging for rules.
Well, I'm not really interested in these good management practices through the farm environment plan. The other thing that concerns me a little bit is that you seem to be a little bit reluctant to have farm environment plans. Is that because you talked about the cost and consultants being involved in that sort of thing?
No, I don't. Sorry, I'm maybe speaking out of turn, but I don't think there's any reluctance from the VFA to have farm environment plans. It's about the challenges of the time frame to implement them. And again, it comes down to if you need to have a consultant for certain things, for certain elements of your farm environment management plan, deer are well down. A consultant who understands deer farming systems is, off the top of my head, we might, there'll be under 10 in the country, probably about 5 or 6 that I can think of. Having the capability to get that through in time before and before requirement to go through to a consenting activity, I think it's going to be quite ambitious for the council. And to my mind, that just places a level of uncertainty over the farmers, a level of cost over the farmers that once they come to do, if they do go through a consenting process and end up with a farm environment management plan with good management practices, just as how they would have identified through their own efforts, it seems to be an extra cost for not a particularly improved environmental outcome.
So we want to avoid that if we can, and farmers would generally be able to do their own plan, wouldn't they?
So I think the way that the beef and lamb LEPs are structured, LEP level 1, pretty much any farmer could do it, maybe with a slight bit of help with their workshops. LEP level 2, they could probably complete most of it. but there would be some components where they might need to seek some consultant specialist help. And then I guess in other regions, it's but if they've done that, they say it still needs to be approved by somebody else to sort of say that yes, they've gone through a process, they've identified the right management practices, but they just haven't made things up.
I think that the nutrient budget side of FEP is probably the more difficult side. Yeah. If it's not necessary to do it, it would be much better.
And just on that, I'll just interject here, the Beef and Lamb website, the page that deals with their plans specifies how many of those plans at guidelines level 1, 2 and 3 would require specialist input, and you're right, it's only the level 1 plan that is anticipated the farmer could do by themselves. After that, they're going to need specialist input.
Yeah.
Is that another question?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much.
And I have no further questions, but thanks very much. So.